Asaf Gilad is a professor of biomedical engineering and radiology at Michigan State University, and he's part of the IQ team at MSU, which is the Institute for Quantitative Health Science and Engineering. Asaf, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me here. I think it's a great opportunity, and I'm looking forward.
So describe your research for us. What do you do?
So my research is in the field of synthetic biology. Synthetic biology is a relatively new field where scientists are looking at biological phenomena from the engineering point of view. So instead of looking at cells and organisms and proteins and try to understand what they are good for or how they work, we look at them from the point of view that what can we do with them? How can we use them to build something new? How we can use it to build a new function? How we can use them to make maybe something that is like electrical circuit where you have an on-off switch. You can make some sort of cellular device that makes a process. And the idea is to take these biological or these engineering principles and use biological tools. And indeed, we call many of these proteins and genes biotools or bioparts. And we try to see what we can do, how we can build with them things that will not exist in nature. In that sense, we make synthetic proteins. When I started my research in that field, we made synthetic genes. Those genes encoded to proteins. And what was special about these proteins is that you can visualize them with MRI, with magnetic resonance imaging. So it's pretty much the same instrument that physicians are using to diagnose patients in the clinic, except that we have smaller MRI systems that we can use for small animal models and to image things in test tubes. So what was unique about it is that the gene was completely synthetic. So we knew exactly what we want to have. As we know, genes are encoding to proteins, and we knew what we are expecting from this protein. We knew what the protein, how the protein should look like, how it should be, how it should function. And we reverse engineered it into a synthetic gene, an artificial gene, a man-made gene that encodes this protein with this function. And indeed, we were able to distinguish this protein from other proteins in the cells with MRI. So that's one way of looking at synthetic biology. And we keep working with it, so we're trying to make it better. We're trying to make it more sensitive, that we can detect lower concentrations of this protein. So now we have different approaches to do it. And one approach that we started to use is evolution-based protein engineering. So you can engineer proteins, and maybe we should go one step backward. And proteins and genes that encode to proteins is what the essence of biology. It's the essence of nature. These are the building blocks of everything. And today we know of proteins that do everything from creating new life all the way to chew up used plastic. You can take proteins and make them into tiny tools that can do everything you want. The question is how, right? That's not easy. That's not trivial, but you know, we have a lot of smart people, and people came up with different ways, and one of the best ways to do it is to use the tools that nature gave us, which is evolution, right? So we want to take these proteins or genes and evolve them into proteins with different functions using the same principles of evolution that there is in nature, which are mutations and selection for the fittest protein. So what is important is to have a big population of mutated genes, or mutated proteins, and then a good screening way to find the one that is really good. And then once you find it, you can go for another generation, right? That's how mutations has been evolved. Much like people evolved wheat and corn to have these big grains with a lot of proteins and polysaccharides and so on, we can evolve proteins, or like proteins can evolve in evolution to do very unique things. This is how organisms evolve to live in volcanoes and very extreme temperatures. And we can use the same principle. So we make libraries of mutated DNA, and then we screen them. And we are looking for the ones that have specific or the most desired function, and then we keep evolving it. These genes can be synthetic genes, like the one we used for the MRI, or these could be natural genes. So we can take genes that were evolved by nature. And in general, if you can have someone else doing the work for you, it's easier. And another example of the research in the lab is a gene that we cloned from a fish. It turns out that there are certain species of fish, certain types of fish, that can navigate using the Earth magnetic field. And they evolved a very specific protein that helps them with this navigation. So, and this is a work that I started back when I was professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and together with Professor Galit Peled. And we took one of these species of fish and we made a DNA library out of it. So we cloned all the genes that this fish has, and we selected for the specific gene that is responsive to electromagnetic field. In fact, it's very interesting, because in order to screen for this protein, we used eggs from a frog. It was very neat. It sounds very easy, but it was very labor intensive. But basically, we had this library of thousands of genes, and we divided it to 10 libraries, and we injected each of them to frog oocytes or eggs. And then we selected for the single egg that responded. Then we took the library of genes that was only, it's 10th of our original pool. We divided it to 10 and we injected it to 10 eggs, and again selected for the one, and so on until we had a single gene that was responder. So now we have this gene, and the gene is very interesting by itself, and we are working on characterizing the genes. And it turns out that, this is kind of an interesting story. So we published the paper. When we published the paper, we were already at Michigan State University. And one of the professors here, Jason Gallant, read the paper, and he's working on electrical fish. And he said, well, you know, I have a lot of fish DNA, so let's see if we have something similar in my fish. So now we are comparing different genes from different species of fishes, and we get to see that there was some evolutionary development that make this protein different. Now, the question is, okay, so you have a protein that is responsive for magnetic field or for electromagnetic fields. Now, what can you do with it? So Galit Peled, and she is using it for many biomedical applications. And if we, from the point of view of synthetic biology, right, from the point of view of synthetic biology, we are looking at it as a switch, right? So basically, we have a switch to turn on and off the cell if we switch on and off electromagnetic field. An electromagnetic field, you can have it outside the body, you can have it outside your petri dish, and you can still switch on and off activity. So one of the projects in the lab is to see if we can use it to build a circuit. If you have a switch and you have these genes that you can detect with MRI, and we have similar genes that we can detect with microscopes, we can detect them with PET, with positron emission tomography. So we have all these genes. These are our readout. So we have the basically the on-off switch, and then we have the light bulb. So now all we need is to put the different parts in between and make a circuit. And that's one thing. And the circuit, you can put something that a reporter gene, something that report on activity inside the cell, or you can put a therapeutic gene. So for example, you can put a gene that encodes to insulin. Right? So suddenly you can make a circuit that when you switch on and off the switch, when you flip the switch, you have secretion of insulin. We are not there yet, but that's where we are going with our research. So you can do it with insulin, you can do it with different proteins, TSH, the hormone that is control thyroid secretion, hormones that are controlling and that can control appetite and mood and so on. So that allows you to build an interface between electronic devices and biological systems. So now you can have part of the system inside the body and part of the system that is external. So that could be some sort of transmitter. The transmitter can be connected to your cell phone using Bluetooth. The telephone could be connected through an app to your physician office. And you can do reading, and you can actually initiate different actions. With synthetic biology, there's much like in computer science, you have the read and the write. So much like what we are doing now. Well, now we are recording. We are recording new information. Then the person that listening to the podcast is reading the information, right? So, you know, can we do it with biological systems? Can we record information and can we read it afterwards? Right. So this is something that I find very interesting, and it's not something that I'm currently doing in my lab, but this is, it's interesting. So I'm going to talk about it. But people in the field are trying to figure out a good way to record. So for example, you can record on DNA, right? You can record information on DNA. That's how protein are encoded. It's DNA has four bases, four nucleotides, and depend on the order, you can record information. In computer science, you record information as a series of ones and zeros. That's a binary code, but you can use code of 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4. So you can basically translate your information, these ones, zeros and ones, into A, B, C, D, and record this information. And it turns out that you can record more information on DNA than on silicon chip. In fact, you can, if you just compare the weight, gram to gram, gram of silicon chip and chips and gram of DNA, you can record 10,000 times more information on the DNA. I hope I get the number right, but that's about the ratio. So you know how can you use these synthetic biology systems to record, and how can you use it to read? Because it's easy to record, but then if it gets crumbled and you can't read it, I mean, what's the point? And people are doing really exciting stuff. I mean, I read a paper a while ago that people recorded a movie on a DNA of bacteria. So you have a bacteria, and the bacteria has a whole short movie, but it's a movie. And the most fascinating thing about it is that they were able to watch the movie afterward. So there's a lot of potential of using these organisms, right? If you can record a movie on a single bacteria, you know, instead of, well, we don't go to Blockbuster anymore, but instead of even downloading from Netflix, you know, you can just sneeze and you can share your movie. But this is the amount of information you can use it. And again, people have been using nature and biological material for many years, right? For the most of it, we use dead biological material, right? We first have to wait for it to be dead. And I'm not just talking about like eating and consumption, but if you build a house of wood, you have to basically wait for the wood to dry up. And we use it to dress ourselves. We use it for cotton. We use it for wool. We use it for eating, but people developed also live organisms for other things. For example, yeasts are being used for baking bread and drink and making beer, right? And these are live organisms that we learn how to use. Now, can we take those organisms and others, and can we use live organisms to be our next, the core of our next computer? You know, there's so much we can learn from nature. So that's in a nutshell, or a little bit more than a nutshell, of what we are doing in the lab and where the synthetic biology field is going.
So, Asaf, let me ask you, if you've given some examples already, but if your research progresses well, what are some of the benefits to people or society that might come out of this, and when might we see some of those? It sounds like we are already.
The biomedical applications, and those are very, very important. But some of them are long-term. And much like with the space program, in the late 60s and 70s, we had people going out to space. And, you know, people thought that conquering space is going to be a big thing. And in fact, I was talking to my daughter and talking about space, and I told her, you know, now with programs like SpaceX, you're probably going to buy a ticket and fly to space the way that you fly to California. But then I thought, well, when I was a kid in the 70s, that's what my parents told me. You know, when you're going to be in your 40s, you're probably going to go to space every day. But the fact is that very few people are going to space. So what was the point? But I think people now are appreciating more and more that there were a lot of benefits for the space program in terms of technology, and I know in terms of material science. So we have all these very cool materials that are derivative of this space program. An analogy for the synthetic biology is that even if we don't have goals that we're going to see, so, you know, because people say, well, you know, how would you get this DNA? You know, how would you get it to the people? I mean, there are ways to do genome engineering, and people are, you know, being more serious about it, and there are hundreds of clinical trials. 20 years ago, people said, well, no problem, we can use viruses. Now people don't really like to use viruses. I mean, it's still, you know, pretty good way to do it, and the safety of the viruses has improved dramatically. But then people started to think, well, you know, we can use stem cells. Stem cells is a good way to deliver, because you can take stem cells from the patient itself, and nowadays you can take skin cells, or, you know, fat cells, and you can either isolate or generate cells from stem cells from this fat or skin tissue, and you can engineer them to express your gene of interest, and then you can transplant them to the same patient. There's no immune rejection, and so on. So this could be a good way to treat many devastating diseases, and that was probably in the 2000s, that was the decade of the stem cells. And now everybody, you know, many labs can produce stem cells. It's not complicated. But lately people started to think about immune cells. Viruses might be dangerous. Well, at the beginning there was the ethical question. I think some people don't like stem cells that much. But now you can see, now people are talking about immune cells. You know, you can take your immune cells, your T cells, or other immune cells, and you can take them out of the body, you can engineer them, and you can train them to recognize tumor. And you can use those cells to track down tumors and to attack them and to kill them, actually identify them in places that other cells or other drugs cannot approach. So one of the projects that we are involved with, and this is a collaboration with a center at Johns Hopkins, is that can we take those immune cells and we can engineer them with our specific proteins, and can we image them with MRI? Can we see where those cells are exactly going in the body, right? And the problem with all these kind of treatments is that when you inject those cells, you usually can assume where they're going to go. You know they're going to go to the lymph nodes. You know they might go to the tumor, but can you actually label them and visualize them and see them with MRI? Yeah. These are some of the clinical applications. And again, much like with a, you know, with a space program, this is what we can envision now. But as science and communication evolves at the rate that it evolves now, you can use it for other things. You can use it to generate new materials. You can use it to generate new ways to solve problems. Obviously, you can use it in agriculture. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ways that I can see and imagine how this technology or these technologies can be beneficial. And there are more that even I cannot envision. Yeah.
So, what are some of the next steps then, as you keep working us off?
So, we are working a lot on evolution of those proteins. We both for imaging and the biological circuits. We are trying to look into different organisms that have different genes. We are testing different kinds of ways to change these proteins. So, for example, when we think about evolution, many of us think about mutations, but we started to think about recombination. So recombination is where you take two different genes or similar genes or alleles or pieces of DNA and you basically mix them together and see what you get. Now, intuitively, you think, well, you know, this is not how things are working. But in real life, this is how most of the biology evolved. This is what happens when you have kids, right? You take DNA from one parent and from the other, and you mix them together and you see what, you know, you get something. And it's usually a good thing that you get. You know, usually from recombination, you get good things. From mutations, I don't know. I mean, it's so we try to look at different ways to evolve these proteins. Yeah. We try to look at different organisms that have different features or different genes that we're using.
So, Asaf, talk to me some more, too, about this collaborative ethos, if you will, that IQ that Chris Kontag is developing and how your work even maybe benefits from this interface of engineering and medicine. And I'm guessing that collaboration is sort of what attracted you to MSU.
Yes. So being part of the IQ, it's a very unique experience. What Chris did, he did a great thing. He brought people from all over the country, and each of them have different set of skills. Then he put them together with a lot of emphasis on collaboration. Of course, there was a lot of support from the university, so we have state-of-the-art equipment, and we have one of the biggest imaging centers. It's pretty impressive, but I think it's all about the manpower and the human factor. And the IQ is build in a way that people have a lot of access one to another. We have this shared space. The IQ is divided to 8 divisions, and each division is like a neighborhood. So we have 4 or 5 labs, 4 or 5 professors with their students that are basically live in kind of like a block or a neighborhood, and we share a whole one big lab. We get to talk with one and the other, and what I like about it, and I honestly didn't like it at the beginning, but the way it's built is that the students are sitting next to the windows, so they have their cubicles. Then there are the professors' offices, so all the professors have offices not next to the window, which I didn't like because I wanted the window. It turns out that in Michigan it's not a big advantage anyways, but especially that we are facing north. Then the lab is on the other side of my office, and we have glass windows. So what it creates is that I can see what's going on in the lab. I can see the students, you know, what they're doing. They can see me. So if they have good results, they just knock on my window, and I can rush to the lab and see what they're doing. So I get to see the results in real time. But then I can always see them in their cubicles, and you know, they can talk to me. We don't have good sound insulation also, so they can, you know, we can just talk through the wall. And I like the fact that we have this glass wall, and we just write things on the wall, And, you know, if I have some sort of idea, I just write it on this glass wall, and the students can comment on it, and they can mark on the wall whatever, you know, they think. And we have these discussions. And what's even nicer about it is that if, you know, one of my colleagues, one of my neighbors, the other professors are walking through and they see my, you know, they see what I, my drawings on the wall, that starts a conversation. Yeah. So they say, well, you know what? I see you have a problem. I have an instrument in my lab that you can use to solve this problem. So we have all these collaborations. So, for example, in my division, which is synthetic biology, we have one guy that is expert in super resolution microscopy. His name is Jens Schmidt, and is a brilliant scientist, and is working on super resolution microscopy. So suddenly we can take our proteins and we can see a single protein, which we couldn't do anywhere else, just because we were chatting, because I was scrambling something on the wall and he saw it and we started to chat and said, well, you know, we have a way to test it. So now we have these really cool movies of single proteins moving in the membranes and we can expand it. We have another guy that just started, a new professor, Tae-ho Kim, and he's making nanoparticles. So suddenly we have this inorganic chemistry capabilities that we didn't have before. I'm working with Galit Pele, who is working on the other side of the floor at the neuroengineering. So the way it's built and the people that we have, they're a very unique environment.
Well, Asaf, thank you so much for telling me about your research today.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
That's Asaf Gilad. He's a professor of biomedical engineering and radiology at Michigan State University. He's part of the IQ team at MSU as well. IQ is the Institute for Quantitative Health Science and Engineering, and there's more online at iq.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White. This is MSU Today.